Blog Talk Radio.
Here we go.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. This is MJ Network. And this is an exciting day because today is the day that the book Beyond the Truth by Bruce Kaufman comes out and everybody gets to buy it on Amazon, at least a million copies, because this is one of my favorite books of the year. And we're going to tell you just a drop about it, because we're not going to give it away. And we're going to tell you, where's my thing on my phone? That would help if I could find my summary. And here we go. I'm going to do something different. I'm going to read it from my book review, which is out there with 27 stars. An officer takes a call and his life will change forever. A robbery at a laundromat where two teens dressed in different colored hoodies robbed the manager at what appears to be gunpoint. Officer Haggerty takes the call and trudges through snow bunks and then on foot to catch these kids. But things get out of control and one got away while the other appeared to have a gun pointed at him and shots ring out and the robber is dead. What happens after that is really tragic. And we're not going to tell you anymore, because the author is here, Bruce Kaufman. Hi, how you doing?
Good, good. How are you, Fran?
Hanging in there, slowly, seriously. And I have it on my Facebook wall. And before I forget, because I just said I was going to do this, and she said it's okay, I am very proud to say that my niece, Danny, aced her nursing test in medical surgical care. We aced it with a very high grade, and her homework partner over here is very proud. So I am proud of you, Danny, and keep up that A-plus average because that's what they require in this family to stay there.
And congratulations, Danny.
Yes, I'm going to tell her. So give our listeners the backstory about John Byron. He's a really cool character. What I like about him is he gets things methodically great. So if somebody was writing a thriller book and wanted to get a criminal, crime scene right, I could actually write it from your book, seriously.
Right. Oh, thank you. That's nice. That's very nice.
Yep.
Yeah, John, I set out to make him, that methodical creature that does what homicides detectives do, in spite of all of the things he has to contend with in his own life. He really goes about, the investigations and supervising and overseeing in a logical way. But it's always his inner demons that he's battling as he works these cases.
He's really great. So tell us, he's got a whole team, right? Nugent, Tran, Pellegrosso, and Garner. How did they come to form that team for him?
I really just wanted to try and create a team that had some diverse aspects to it and worked well as a cohesive unit, but at the same time were really all different types of people from different backgrounds and different experiences. And the reason I set out to do that was because from my own experience of working in the police department in that kind of environment, I think one of the things that people don't get to see, that never actually do that job is how different really police officers are. We do come from all walks of life and we do have all kinds of different experiences that we bring to the table and different strengths. And in spite of all of those differences, once we become a team and a cohesive unit, it's amazing how much can get accomplished. How it's almost like there's so many different viewpoints that it's a great way to examine and expose the case and try to pick apart and figure out exactly what mm-hmm. did happen. And all those varying viewpoints and strengths that come to the table really, it keeps it from being just a one-dimensional look at something. There's a lot of people that think outside the box and think differently than John does. And it really makes for an interesting read, I think.
It did, because I got eye strain. I just sat down and read it. I seriously did. But one of these days, because I saw you got a whole bunch of copies yesterday, I said, one of these days I'm actually going to get a real copy. And I have to say HarperCollins printed one out for me right away.
Oh, that's
but
awesome.
They have to learn.
That's great.
They printed, yeah, they did, except that they have to make the print larger next time. Seriously.
Oh, is it hard to read?
Yeah, well, sent me James Heyman's book, Fatal Obsession. They had to redo it because I literally couldn't see the print. The print was smaller than the smallest font. Yeah, it was so small, I couldn't deal with that. So, the acting chief of police, I'm not so sure about this guy. Tell us about him. I don't know.
You know, I thought it would be fun to, in the first mm-hmm. couple of books, we had the chief in the first novel, Stanton, and then things move on and things change, and I wanted to kind of mix that up. Instead of having the chief who was already running the show at the police department and trying to move on to another department, which is sort of what, you know, I mean, that's the life of a chief. You're always trying to move up to a larger department and a bigger organization. But we'd already seen that a couple of times, and I thought it would be interesting, especially given the case that they had to work here, if we had the second in command be the acting chief after Stanton departed. And, of course, his motivation is to become the full-time chief. You know, generally there's the nationwide search where they try to find the best person for the job. And many times it may be the acting chief, or at least, you know, that's who wants to have the job. So what would he be willing to do, or what would he use as motivations? Which side of any issue would he take in order to better his chances of becoming chief? I thought that was an interesting dynamic to add that would really kind of create a stressful situation for everybody.
It did for the reader, me, because I really think John should move up right now in the whole show. Oh, really. It's time he became, you know, the mayor or chief of police or something. He's really good. So, that's just my point of view. What happens if that's a chain of events? Yep. I wanted to tell him, John, like, you know, just step on his toes. Don't worry about it.
Right.
What happens that starts the chain of events that causes Officer Haggerty to kill Tommy Plummer, and why didn't they believe him? He had no choice, I guess.
Right. You know, I mean, one of the things I wanted to sort of illuminate with this story was that, you know, it's really been a topical thing. I mean, for the last 3 or 4 years, this has really been almost overwhelming in the media, the situations that get covered. And, you know, there's also a lot of situations that happen like this that are never looked at. It's only the ones that seem juicy or maybe have a good spin, or maybe there's part of a video or something, or an eyewitness. And my point here is, having worked these cases and actually investigated police shootings myself as part of a team, there's so much more to these issues than people imagine. There's so much more to what goes on behind the scenes, what the officer involved in the shooting experiences, both during the event and after, and what it's like for the investigators to try and piece, you know, what really happened back together. In spite of, you know, really overwhelming odds, you know, there's a lot of public outcry on some of these things. You know, there's certainly I think, a force of, you know, that rush to judgment mentality that the detectives have to deal with. And really, like any case where a death is involved, you know, for the investigator, everything is about slowing things down and examining what you have that's real and what is just opinion. And it's hard to do when you've got a lot of people that have an interest in how one of these things plays out. So I wanted to kind of give the reader a sense of, you know, how complex some of these things can actually be and how much more there is. It's almost like an iceberg where, you know, from a media standpoint, when you get a piece of one of these stories given to you in the paper or on television, you're only getting a small piece. You're only seeing a small look at what happened, and you don't know what all the other things are that go on behind the scene, and that's what the investigators have to contend with.
Yeah, well, I was able to follow it from what you're writing, seriously, and I'm following it from Allison Brennan's book, too, because obviously she was into that also. It made it easier for me to understand the steps that go in to, you know, doing a criminal investigation. You'd be surprised how many books I've read where they said, huh? it makes no sense. They really wouldn't do that, you know, or a real officer wouldn't do that. So when you're doing a criminal investigation, I mean, I read so many of these, too many of them maybe, I don't know. What other teams besides your police department and everything, they bring in the FBI, they bring in CSI, they bring in forensics. How many teams do they bring in? Plus the crime scene? I mean, how many people altogether?
Well, really, when you're writing these books, you have to take a little bit of a liberty, and sometimes there are actually more people involved in the investigation in real life than you see in these. And really, that's about trying to make it digestible for the reader. If I had 20 people doing an investigation, you know, as a reader, you'd have a hard time keeping track of that. But, generally what I have there is representative of the whole, which is, you know, you have somebody that would be overseeing it from a department level, because regardless of whether or not it was a police officer that actually was the person who has taken a life, it is still a death investigation. And so you go after it that way, and you want to find out and piece together what happened. But at the same time, because it was a police shooting in Maine, the way it works is the investigating department agency that has jurisdiction over that is the Attorney General's office. And so they have an arm that actually comes in and investigates police shootings. That's what they do. And it's almost like a joint investigation in that obviously the police department itself can only be the finder of facts for internal things and can be the gatherer of facts for something that may, you know, go criminal or not go criminal. And the Attorney General's office would then be the one. Let's say this was a bad shooting and Hagerty acted impulsively and did something that was way beyond the norm. Then it would become a case that, you know, conceivably could be a manslaughter case, could be a murder case. And so as the Attorney General's office in Maine is the investigative body for those things and prosecuting body for those things, they would be ultimately the overseer of what happened. So you really have two different organizations that are working in some ways together, but really have different goals in mind here. They have different things they're trying to get to the bottom of. And like I say, from the police department standpoint, you're looking to see what actually did happen, because there was, an armed robbery, which is a crime they would investigate that leads into this. And then they also have their own internal policies and standards that have to be adhered to. You know, did the officer follow his training? Was he in fear for his life? All of those things that you look at. And it's really, you've got two different investigations almost going on simultaneously when a police shooting happens. So it really adds to the complexity of something that would normally only be, you know, if it was a traditional, it was a murder case that had nothing to do with the police, then the police department would be the one that ran it. And again, the prosecuting authority would be the Attorney General's office. But you've got two different investigations happening when a police department is involved in a shooting like that.
Do they work well? You know, I watch so many programs, not too many, Criminal Minds and all the rest of that sometimes. I know some of it is not real. And they, you know, solve everything so quickly. Yeah, okay, not really. Do the organization, the FBI, the CIA, and all of them, do they work together? Or is there like a loop for power, you know, a power struggle here that I want to be in charge or I'm in charge of this and you can't touch my case? Do they do that?
Well, I think with any cases, I think at the ground level, that's talked about a lot, because there obviously is interagency cooperation and there's also interagency resistance. And I think sometimes you find that it works better at the street level, at the ground level, where the investigators are actually doing the work. We all seem we tend to get along much better because we know what the job is, we know what the stakes are, and we know that in order to have a successful outcome, you have to play nice with each other. I think where the problems generally start, if there are problems, is at the upper levels, and there's a lot more to it than just the case sometimes. It's about, you know, it may have something to do with blame, it may have to do with funding, who's actually getting credit if something gets solved, and, you know, who's getting the money and where is it coming from? And there's a lot of things in major cases that come into play that are beyond just the investigation. So I think sometimes you'll have the upper echelon will actually be in conflict with each other because of all of those things, you know, who gets the credit and this and that. And I don't think at the street level, I don't think that was ever an issue. I know in any cases I worked with investigators in the AG's office, I felt like, you know, we were on the same team, and we were all trying to get to the truth mm-hmm. and the bottom of something. Working with the FBI, I felt the same way. A lot of times the only issues really became at the upper levels of our individual organizations, where sometimes they didn't play nice with each other. Sometimes it even has things to do with, like, who's going to release the information to the press. Mm-hmm. You know, there'll be a fight about that sometimes, and because, you know, the chief may see things one way and want to get out in front of it early or whatever, and then, you know, the other agency may not see it that way or may want to control the information that goes out. So there's all kinds of little things like that can add drama to a story but are actually based in fact.
Well, one of the characters that I really was not happy with, but she was a strong character, but she was not very nice, is Lucinda Phillips. What was her problem? And why was she called in? And she really was, oh, my God. And then we have the acting chief, and he doesn't back up his own guy. Oh, she said, you really created a real witch over there. Except that, you know, Diane better watch out. No, seriously. She really better watch out.
No, I wanted to be able to throw in some other pieces to this where there were personal relationships that could affect how things were going as this case went on. In Lucinda's situation, she, as you know from the former books, was John's really equal as a detective sergeant with the Maine State Police. And they worked well together in the past. And now she is post-retirement, and she's in a new position where she works as an investigator for the Attorney General's office. And so, really, it's sort of an odd situation where they used to work well together, but they were on two different, part mm-hmm. of two different agencies. And now the same thing has happened, but she is on the side that John bristles really at anything she says or does, because he is worried that, you know, that there'll be a bad outcome, and that this may be looked at where Hagerty made a mistake or did something that he shouldn't mm-hmm. have done. And you know, his concern is that it may be a bad shoot. Not that it changes the way he investigates. You know, the truth is mm-hmm. what the truth is. And we all, you know, you kind of have to, that's part of the job. Not everybody's going to like what you find out. But because he obviously has some allegiance to the officer that works with him and that he's friends with, mm-hmm. Her position really almost represents a threat to him, because he's not sure whether she's operating, you know, as a diligent investigator who's just looking for the facts, or if she might be doing somebody else's bidding that has, you know, political aspirations and wants a case to come out a certain way. And so it definitely creates problems. And then the fact that they've known each other for so long, and there is a personal attraction, as you might remember, actually lends itself to some more drama in a personal sense that's outside of the professional investigation that's going on. So I think she definitely adds an element that hasn't necessarily existed in the prior books. So.
Well, then we have the press, as we listen to all the press the last couple of days of the tragedies that happened, two of them. It was horrible. I cried my eyes out to know that a temple was attacked like that, and so many people were killed for no reason. And so what happens when Hagerty is on leave and the press incites the protests? And that happens. We know that happens. And then you have a reporter that leaks it. Why would a reporter, leak something like that, leak out the information when he's perfectly told, don't do it until we know what's happening? Why do they do that? To incite media to get the story first? Why would they do that? That's so wrong.
Yeah, I think we're in an odd time where a lot of things that used to be held as sacred now are sort of just thrown by the wayside. And you just touched on it. I think that's right. I think there's such a drive to be the first one to break a story. There's such a drive to be the only one to get information that's not coming from someplace else. And that's, you know, that's ego on the part of, in this particular case, Davis Billingsley plays the spoiler well in that regard. He sees himself as something of a bigger deal than he is. And he strives for something more than what he has. He doesn't want to continue working for the Portland Herald forever. You know, he has starry eyes, and he sees something bigger for him down the road. So I think he wants to be the next Woodward and Bernstein kind of person. So he sort of goes off unchecked and wants to do whatever it takes to get where he wants to go, no matter what, you know, what kind of issues he may cause. And that really creates another level of tension for John and the team. And you know, that's a real thing. I mean, I obviously take mm-hmm. some liberties with that to make the writing more fun to read. But there's some reality to that. I mean, the bottom line is that the media has one goal, and that is to get the information out as quickly and hopefully as accurately as they can to the general public. But as an investigator, when you're working these cases, information getting out before you're ready for it to go out can have a disastrous effect on an investigation that you're working. And sometimes we keep things close to the vest on purpose, because if you're putting out information and the person responsible, that, you know, let's say the bad guy in one of these cases, gets that information before you want them to, it can have a detrimental effect on how the case investigation goes. It can blow a case. And so I think there's a constant struggle. It's the nature of the beast. You know, the media has one goal, and the police department has the other. And in Davis Billingsley's case, as a reporter, he sort of goes off half-cocked. Now, he's looking for the truth as well, but he's sort of, you know, he doesn't think about the consequences of how he does it or how quickly he puts things out and whether or not it will hurt the case. Whereas John, that's all he thinks about. So, you know, it's natural, I think, that would put them at odds.
Well, we have the gun, that we have a flashlight. So why don't they think that he had a gun? And they don't think that Tommy had a gun. They think that was something else. But we didn't get into
right,
him
well,
yet.
And they,
Tom, yeah, it's right, scary.
They really don't know. Yeah, they really don't know. I mean, and that's the whole point of these things. You know, John doesn't know any more than the, you know, the general public thinks they do. It's a question of, you know, could this have happened or could that have happened? And barring being able to come up with the piece of evidence that puts it together and shows what did happen, it becomes a lot of people making assumptions based on what is known. And I think you can see quickly in this book that certain group or people sort of circle the wagons, and they start taking sides in this thing without even knowing the facts. And, I think we see that on a daily basis. I think we see it all over the world where that kind of thing happens. I think it's human nature to jump to conclusions, because if you've never actually worked a case like this and you don't know the sensitivities of it and you don't actually have yourself anything to risk, it's easy, I think, for us all to just assume we know what happened and then you lock down your own opinion and that's it. You don't sway from it. But you can see how dangerous that kind of attitude is. You know, and I think in the age of social media, that's become even a bigger deal, because everybody has an opinion. You know,
yeah,
we didn't
the problem
all have a
is that
before.
I know it's scary, because you know every reporter reports it how they want to say it, and no two reporters report it the same. It's like no two witnesses report the same thing and see everything the same way, which is
right.
So
no,
as
well,
the events unravel, that's right. Yeah, I mean, you could be walking
one
down
of
the street
that
and
happened,
like. Yeah, I mean, you don't know.
One of the things that happens is that, you know, and police officers have to deal with this, is, you know, people do intentionally lie to you during an investigation. I mean, that we all know that happens. That goes without saying, especially if there's something to hide. But also you have people that actually, because of their own personal history, or because of, you know, maybe they were under the influence of something, or they've had an experience in their life that shapes the way they view the world. People can, three people can sit there and watch the same incident. You and I may actually witness something at the same time and not see the same thing happen. And that's not you and I lying about what happened. It's that we don't have a trained eye to try to break it all down. It's like one of the examples I love to give to people is, how many times have you watched a sporting event on television or even live at the game, and you're convinced that the runner was safe at first base or but the ball was dropped and, you know, they caught it on the grass. And then you see the replay and you were wrong. You know, it has to be slowed down for you to see that you were dead wrong and the umpire got it right or whatever. Well, criminal cases where there are witnesses are very similar to that. No two people, persons seem to see the same thing when they're witnessing a crime. And so that makes the investigator job even harder, because you have to try and figure out you know, did they really see what they're telling you, or are they making the assumption that this is what happened? You know, it's like if you see me walk into a house with a gun and then you hear a gunshot and I walk back out, you assume that I'm the shooter, but you actually didn't see any crime. You have no idea what happened inside the house. And I think it's a natural tendency for people to jump to conclusions based on what they do have for information. They'll just fill in the blanks themselves. So that always makes it harder to do a case.
I know. That's scary. So we have the manager of the laundromat. And what did we learn about Tommy as we get to know him? And the manager of the laundromat, what does he say about him? And I didn't like him either.
So Tommy really, Tommy Plummer is sort of the local celebrity in that he is a high school basketball star for Portland High School. And he is a big deal. He's made it into his senior year. He has a following because of his talent and what he's actually managed to help the city of Portland do, you know, in the basketball world. But we learn that there's another side to Tommy, the side that not everybody else gets to see, and that he's sort of an egomaniacal, spoiled kid who gets away with more than he should because of who he is and what he's able to do. And there's slack that gets cut over the years that I think actually leads to what happens here. And he's not the same person that everybody thinks he is. And so that's another challenge for the investigators, because Tommy is known by, you know, your average citizen or your average fan of Portland basketball in one way, but then there's the other side of Tommy that the investigators begin to uncover. And it's sort of that, you know, he's been put up on a pedestal kind of thing, and then you realize that he wasn't deserving of being on that pedestal. So that's another thing that you have to fight when you're working cases like this, because he's a popular kid. You've got a lot of people that immediately come out and support him, and then, you know, question what the police did, and, you know, did any of these things happen the way they were reported? And people start throwing around the conspiracy theory thing. And I think that's just human nature. You know, if you know a person one way, and then you only know them that way, the people that know them better would actually have a different viewpoint. So, and I think we tend to do that as a society with cases whenever there's a high profile person involved. You know, like O.J. Simpson being the most recognized name. You know, I don't know how everybody else felt, but I mean, I grew up, you know, looking at O.J. Simpson as a hero. Like, you know, what he was able to do on the football field, and, you know, I remember seeing him in the luggage commercials, and, you know, to me, that was the O.J. Simpson I grew up knowing. But of course, I didn't know O.J. Simpson. I had no idea, you know, what he was like as a person. I had no idea that, you know, there were ever domestic problems or any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think all of us at the same time were shocked to find out that, you know, that he could have done something like what he was accused of. And I think Tommy Plummer's situation is very similar in that, where there's the side that everybody thinks they know because he's a popular person and, you know, and well known. And then there's the real person that's behind that.
I think everybody's got the real person behind something that nobody knows. Mm-hmm. Seriously.
Right.
I think so.
Right. No, it's true. Yeah, no, it's true.
Yeah. Well, they talked to Tommy's teammates, and as an educator, I know that people aren't allowed to come in unless there's permission. So how come they were allowed to talk to the teammates, and what did they learn about him from his friends? Because they thought he was the best thing, but not everybody thinks he's the best thing in the world.
Right, right. And that's really where some of that persona, the problems with Tommy himself begin to unravel when the detectives begin to talk to the teammates, and not everybody was enamored by Tommy because he had that other side to him.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different kind of scenario because you're not talking about these kids being interviewed as suspects in a murder case. They're witnesses, or they're witnesses to the background where they're trying to put together, you know, what Tommy really was, what he might have been into, who he hung out with, who he might have been with that night. And so, yeah, it's a different kind of a situation. So the police officers, the detectives in this case, actually go and begin to to question and talk to some of his teammates to get a better handle on, you know, if anybody had information on what he might have been up to the night that the shooting happened or who he might have been hanging out with. So a lot of the people that are questioned in these cases aren't necessarily looked at or considered as suspects, but they are people that might possess information that helps lead the police to unravel what really happened.
That is true. But we meet his parents, and we know right from the get-go that they're hiding something, that the father is seriously hiding something. And John pushes himself to the limit. So he wants it to, and who wants to take out the guy that's in jail? I mean, Haggerty. Who wants to hurt him? I mean, seriously, that isn't nice.
Yeah, so you have a whole different plot line that's actually going on beneath the surface, and it has to do with the robbery itself, which on its face, it's another thing that I wanted to be able to show that, again, not everything is as it seems. We've all seen stories of home invasions on the news, and you, I think the first thing you try to think of is that, you know, it's just a couple of the nice family sitting down having a dinner or going to bed at night, and then suddenly crazy people are breaking into their house. And then the reality sometimes sets in where you find out that's not what happened, and the family might have been into the things they shouldn't have been into, and suddenly, you know, they're victimized by drug dealers or whatever it is. So there's a subplot going on below the surface, and it has to do with the robbery itself of the laundromat. On its face, seems to be just that somebody held up the laundromat and wanted the money that was in the safe. And then they quickly learn that something else is going on here, and they begin to suspect that the owner of the laundromat might have been into something that was illegal that led to this, and that there's a lot more than meets the eye here. So.
Oh, wow. So how did you create Trans and all those characters that are so loyal to John? I mean, I love Trans. So why do they miss the fact that somebody's trying to hurt the other guy? And Trans is my favorite guy, and I like the technical. He's technical, whatever. So why are these guys so loyal to him? I mean, usually you get a couple of them that, oh, I want to be, you know, ahead, I don't care, you know, the boys, blah, blah, blah. But they all love John. I can't blame them, but I like Trans the best. Sorry.
Yeah, I think Tran is actually fun. He's a fun character. And it's funny because everybody, you know, they all want to know if I created any of these characters based on the people I work with. And none of them were created, as exact matches to the people that I worked with. But I did occasionally take quirks or traits of some of those people and install them into my characters. Tran really, though, is almost entirely made up. I didn't work with anyone that was exactly like Tran. And I like the fact that John is really kind of a stickler. He's sort of an old school detective sergeant. And he likes to run, you know, a tight ship and wants people focused on what the actual thing is that they're doing and doesn't want a lot of distractions. And he doesn't suffer fools well. He doesn't put up with people trying to micromanage from up above. And I think the detectives that work with them over time develop an appreciation for that and recognize that that he's always looking out for them and that there are fights going on behind the scenes that they're not always privy to, where he's really good. You know, he'll defend those detectives, and I think that pays back where they're loyal to him, which is kind of nice. Tran is a fun character because Tran, I think I set out to sort of create that millennial type of person who's not old school. You know, he didn't come from the world that John came from, and John's world, really, his police time is very highly influenced by the memories of his father, who was a prior Portland police officer. And so John brings a lot of old school mentality to the job, and Tran has none of that. Tran is extremely talented in his ability to manipulate and to get into things and figure out things on a technical level. And John respects his abilities very highly. But John is also put off by Tran's sort of, you know, it's not necessarily that he doesn't appreciate rank or that he doesn't look up to that, but I don't think he understands the way that works. Like, he's Very seldom does he call John Sergeant. It's always Stripe Dude or something, you know, kind of a surfer mentality. And it's funny because really Tran is so good at what he does that John sort of gives him a pass on that. And John generally wouldn't put up with that from anybody, but he does put up with that from Tran. He's a fun character because he's, I think in real life, you know, the people that do the technical things like that where they have a specialty, but they're not out there, you know, knocking on doors and questioning people. I think it's easy as investigators to sort of, you know, forget about the guy who's stuck over in the closet doing all this work and helping generate leads for you and piecing things together. And that's really what Tran is. He's often forgotten, but I think John gets it and highly appreciates him. And a lot of times Tran will actually end up finding that key piece of evidence that will lead him in a different direction, which is kind of neat. So
that is cool. But I really like the girl on CSI, Penelope, that has all that equipment. I really think everybody should have that. That's amazing. And we're like, how does she figure that out? And in real life, do they have that? I don't think so. So
no, it would be
acting,
nice if they had all those tools, wouldn't it?
Yeah, wouldn't it? I mean, yeah, well, that access, and they always find the guy. They always know the location. I go, like, yeah, in real life, they have to scrounge and pray to God that the helicopters and the drones find them. I don't know.
Right.
So was the acting chief, did you base him on anybody, or did you make him up? Because I still didn't like him.
No, I made him up, but again, one of the things that I wanted to be able to show is that, especially in a case like this where so much is on the line, you know, for me, it's never really about what is done or what is said. It's always about what the motivation behind something is. Why is somebody doing something a certain way? Why are they saying something a certain way? And very much like what the goals are for the media in these books, and what the goals are for John Byron and his team aren't the same thing. And so that's where the conflict develops. So I wanted to show that the ability to have those conflicts also exists within the police department. Because if you have, in this case, if you have an acting chief who wants to become the actual chief of the police department, he is trying to line his ducks up in a row where things work out the best for him. And so he doesn't know any more than anyone else does what the actual end result of this case will be. So he's almost trying to play a chess match. He's trying to hedge his bets and try to stay on the good side of the city manager while, you know, trying to put himself in the best position to be the chief. But he doesn't know which side, you know, the case will actually play out. He doesn't know whether or not the officer will be found to have been, negligent in his duties or whether or not he'll be cleared. So he sort of plays a spoiler because he has a different agenda. I mean, his agenda really is him. He's put himself first, and he's trying to make the right decisions that don't jeopardize his ability to become the chief. So I didn't base him on anybody, but, you know, obviously I've worked for people who had high aspirations for their own, their own future promotional situation. And I wanted to give people a different look at what can happen with inside an agency, too, when something this big is on the line.
Well, we also have the mayor, not like him either, who seems to like the media hog, and he didn't care whether it was true or false. He just said, just get the guy, get him down, get whatever, and don't worry about it. And, you know,
right.
After listening to news, I'm beginning to think that he's more real than anybody else.
It's the same kind of situation. That's somebody who, unlike the deputy chief, it's not just about getting a promotion within the police department, but there is a political angle there. And I think that's a reality of politics. I mean, here we are coming up on election season, and everybody's looking to get the upper hand. It's no different than any election season. And there, you know, the goal obviously is power and control or additional seats or an actual position that you don't hold currently. And this particular case becomes something that's highly important. And there's a lot of people who want to be, in this book, there's a lot of people trying to take advantage of that. Be it a good outcome or a bad outcome, they're trying to put themselves in a position to have it affect them in a positive way for what it is thereafter. And many times, obviously, that flies in the face of what the detectives are trying to do, which is just get to the bottom of the truth without interference. And so, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on in this book. There's a lot of different layers happening that are creating additional stress for the investigators and really detracting and distracting from the issue that's at hand, which is just, was it a good shooting, wasn't a good shooting, you know, is what it comes down to. So.
Well, the one thing you've never had is like a corrupt police officer yet. And we get them all the time. You know, and
well,
in a lot of the books I read, I said that, you know, he doesn't have a corrupt
right.
police officer, even though there's some of the people that I'm not crazy about, that, like
right.
Lucinda, we're going to get to her in a minute. Seriously.
Right. Well, you know, and in the first book, there were actually, obviously, the backstory
yeah.
dealt with a lot of police corruption. And I it's funny because
yeah.
I needed to use that because I wanted to tell a story that gave you, as a reader, a real good look at John Byron and who John Byron was and what shaped him to turn him into the person that he is today. So it involved a lot of the backstory with his father and the former police officers that used to work for the department. So there was some police corruption there, but it was prior to John's time on the job. And it's funny because every once in a while you'll get I'll get a negative review from somebody that got, actually
mm-hmm.
in one review I was called a traitor, which I found very
very
ironic. I think most people recognize that, you know, that it's fiction, but I'm also addressing the fact that, you know, we are also human beings, and occasionally, you know, a corrupt police officer will slip through the cracks and get into the door. Or as a result of rubbing up against the bad side of society, tend to give in to temptation and become a corrupt cop. But I do think largely that is a rarity, and luckily the vast majority of the men and women that do the job are not like that. You know, it's funny, we talk about that. That comes up once in a while when we do a conference or a panel, and I'll be, you know, in a conversation with an ex-police officer or a writer or a mystery writer. And we discussed that, and it's just funny that I think there's just two schools of thought. I think society sometimes sees police officers a certain way, and that might be because of televisions and movies. But, you know, the reality is this. I think your average police officer definitely doesn't think that way. We talk about all the over the years where you maybe seized a large amount of money or drugs or whatever it is, and from my standpoint as a police officer, you know, you wanted the biggest bang for the buck. You know, I wanted to try to catch the bad guy with a lot of money, you know, ill-gotten gains and a lot of drugs and this and that. It never, ever occurred to me to try and take any of that. You know, that's something that doesn't enter a police officer's mind, not a real police officer. And it's just funny how I think people have a different opinion of that because they see a lot of that on television. And, you know, it makes for good drama, and occasionally when it makes sense to the story, I will certainly use those things. But I'm not, you know, the reality is it's not like that. That is a rarity. You know, when police officers screw up, it's usually something smaller than that. They're not, you know, major kingpins of criminal activity. So, but as you say, there are police officers in there who sometimes can do a good job, but also are not. The kind of people that you hang out with. There's a few in there that you actually hate to see. And I get emails sometimes wanting to know when certain people are going to ever meet their demise. So that's funny. That means I've created a character that you don't like. So that makes me happy.
It makes me happy too. But before I forget, Monday, Patricia Hale scratches you. And on the 7th, someone we all know and love, who's writing the new murder she wrote, Manuscript for Murder, John Land, takes the spotlight. On Veterans Day itself, this is really interesting. The author, it's not his real name, he calls himself I Am Waiting. It's called In My Mom's Mother's Memory. He never got his VA benefits. He's in his 70s, so we're going to bring it out and what happened and what he's gone through all these years. On the 20th, somebody we all know and love, Vincent Zandri, Flower Man. On the 14th, somebody else we all know and love, her new movie is coming out, Island Zero, and I get to do the promo for the movie for Tess Gerritsen. And it's a horror, and it's scary. And on the 26th, Bo Wagner will be there with Network Exposed. And on the 12th of Yeah, the 12th, I have Cindy McDonald, I think, if she sends me the book. On the 28th, we have Artie Van Wy, and he's a 9/11 survivor. And that's just some of what's coming up in December, and there's a whole lot more. But we've got about 15 minutes, and when the harsh reality of who had the gun and who was involved and the secret would have caused undue death, tragedy comes out. So how did the police sort it out? When you finally get all the pieces together, and you know who did it, we're not saying who did it, and why they did it, and how they did it, how do you sort it out? And then Lucinda was the one that was questioning Sean, and I didn't like her questioning. She's not very nice. And then she makes a play for John, and that was really not nice. And if I were Diane, I'd knock her out. Seriously. No, really. So how do you, I mean, you dealt with this in real life. What happens when all the pieces fit together? How do you finally get it down and get the guy and get him prosecuted and make sure he never sees the light of day ever again?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's always a convoluted process, and there's always so many, you know, things that you know, one of the things that's fun about these cases is obviously when you're writing fiction, for the most part, you can wrap things up and, you know, good conquers evil and the case gets solved. In real life, it doesn't always work that way. And I think one of the reasons I chose to write fiction instead of true crime is because I think after, you know, 27 plus years, I've had enough true crime. And it's almost a cathartic process for me to write this stuff where I get to put a lot of reality in, and you get to see as a reader a lot of the stress that these detectives go through to work these cases. But at the end of the day, things work out the way you hope they would in real life. And unfortunately, that doesn't always happen. I mean, there are cases that just don't get solved. And in this particular case, there are so many things happening that the detectives are not initially aware of, that it's really, and you've got multiple agencies involved, that it's really almost, you know, that cliche, I think, of peeling back the layers of the onion. And you're trying to, as the detectives work the case, they're trying to discount the things that really are not relevant or are only distractions and get to the truth, because there's a lot of people telling different stories. There are a lot of people who have different things they're trying to hide on this case here. And it's you have to never give up. The detectives have to keep looking at it, have to keep chiseling it away until they can see what's really, what's real and what's left after all the other stuff has been taken away. And in this case, it takes a while for that to happen. And Diane obviously steps in and becomes a huge part of that. One of the things I set out to do in this book, to make it real again for the reader, which is really what I've done with the whole series, I want you to feel, as you're reading this, I want you to feel so close to these characters, and especially John, that you feel like you're going along for the ride with them, and that you are, if they're struggling or suffering, that you're suffering right along with them, that you understand what's at stake and how hard that can be emotionally to put your life on hold while you work these cases. And in this particular book, I set out to really ramp that up, because we've gotten to know John, and we've gotten to know what some of his human frailties are. And I thought, you know, given the nature of this case, how much would be at stake and how personal this would be for John, I wanted to really up the ante where he was tested beyond what he has been tested with the other books. And it has to do with, you know, fortitude and being able to overcome your demons and do the right thing. And John, I think at one point in this book, definitely lets his emotions get the better of him. Again, he always seems to do things for the right reason, which is sort of one of the things I've kind of adhered to as a rule with him. But it doesn't mean he always does the right thing. And so that, in my mind, gave a realistic spin on this, in that one of the things that we all know, he's battling alcohol addiction. And one of the things that people that I have worked with and have been close with over the years seem to have in common, especially in a law enforcement kind of situation where you're constantly the one that people come to solve their problems, is that we're not real good at asking for help when we have issues ourselves that we're not able to deal with. And so I wanted this particular story to be the catalyst that would drive John in one of two directions. He was either going to self-destruct, and that would be, you know, really the beginning of the end of John, or he would do what we hope you know, all the people we care about would do, which is that you'd reach out and actually admit that you can't do it yourself and ask for help. And so that was one of the things I set out to try to accomplish when I started writing this book. And I felt like, to be honest to the reader, I needed to have a plot that was big enough and personal enough that it would sell that John would do exactly what I have him do in this book. So I think that worked really well. It was hard to write. As you might imagine, there was a lot of emotion mm-hmm. that went into some of these scenes as I was writing them.
Yeah.
It actually got me choked up while I was writing. So
I know, especially when he has to deal with his past. I'm saying, like, how did
right.
you create that? Because I thought he was going to fall apart, and I get the feeling at the end we're going to learn more in the next book.
Right.
About that.
Right.
Yeah,
and that, and when you're very good at that. When I started writing the series, one of the things I wanted to do was to create a character arc for all the characters, really, all the main players, but John especially. I wanted to send him on a journey, almost a journey of self-discovery, where he learned so much about himself in the first book that he, you know, had grown up believing one thing and then found out he was wrong. And so I wanted him to have that kind of spiritual discovery where he really would be where I put him by the end of this third book. I kind of had those things in mind when I started writing the first one. And so what I didn't want to do was create a character that was really the same character in every book. I didn't want him to be in the same place, at the same, you know, the way he would handle things being exactly the same. I wanted him to grow as a character as the series went on. So as good things and bad things happen to him, relationships or the job itself, that John would have to step up and change and adapt to become a more realistic character. And that was kind of my goal. So now after the first three, I saw John's life at a different point. So now he, you know, you've read the book, but without giving too much away, mm-hmm. once he crosses that new threshold, now that will present a whole different set of challenges for him to try and maintain that and build upon it. So I almost look at, you know, the first three books were almost like act one, if you will, even though the stories were different. And as far as Sean's life was concerned, and now I think, you know, if I'm lucky and I get a book four, five, and six, that will be act two of John's life. It's kind of how I'm looking at this.
Okay, so I'm going to ask the $42 million question because we have about 5 minutes. The ending lets us know that John has to face his past and his demons, and he's going to change in the future. So where do you see him next? And Lucinda, I'm glad you did what you did because, you know, Diane is my person and not her, and I really didn't think he belonged with her, and even though she was inappropriate and rude. I can't blame her. You know, you got to try, but you're going to lose, lady. Forget it. He's loyal.
Right.
Thank God, you know, there's somebody. So where do you see him next? And will he remain with Diane? Is she going to come back? And you can't kill off Nugent, Trans, or Pelo Grosso. You can't kill them off. Sorry, I've spoken. And you can't kill John. Oh, seriously, you can't.
I do have plans for the two of them. And as you can see in the first three books, you can see that they're in some ways they're very good for each other, and in other ways mm-hmm. they're terrible for each other because they both have their own baggage and different things that they're trying to do with their lives, and they're really a different age. I mean, she's actually significantly younger than John.
Yeah.
But I see that continuing to develop. I have ideas for where I want to see that go, but I think it's funny. I never want to throw it out there and give it away, but I also am never positive that my characters will not have different ideas. Sometimes I have had ideas that I plan on doing, and by the end of the book, my characters take a different direction, and it makes more sense than what I had set out to do. So I think John and Diane will probably drive that relationship mm-hmm. in the direction that it makes the most sense. So, but I will say that it's an ongoing thing for sure. I think the readers will be pleased with where things go in the future. So
when is it coming out? When am I getting it? And are you finished with the next one? Do you have a title?
No, I don't. The next one is not finished. This one is out. Actually, it dropped today. So I'm very excited. We're doing a big launch tonight in Portland, Maine, at the Millows Floating Wharf in Portland. And we are partnering with Canines on the Frontline as a beneficiary mm-hmm. of some of the proceeds tonight, which is really cool. The fourth book is the tentative title, the working title, is Within Plain Sight, and I
oh,
am
nice.
About a third of the way through that manuscript now, and I'm happy with it. I think that'll be another book that people will definitely will be enthralled by. So, but I'm not going to tell you anything about it.
No, don't. It's okay. It's okay. It's okay because Cheryl's listening from Partners in Crime. She's been on for the whole show, and the minute you give it to her, she'll send it to me. I know it because I have to have it. And she knows that she has
That's
to have
great.
It too. And if she didn't read this, Cheryl,
That's
you need
great.
To read it. It's fantastic. But stop in the beginning. Otherwise, you know, just, what's the point? So where can everybody find out about you and your work? I know you're coming to the Thriller Fest. They actually invited me again, I think.
Good, good, good. I'm looking forward to seeing you down there. Yep. You can find out all about me and John Byron at Coffin, BruceRobertCoffin.com. And I also have an Amazon author page. You'll be able to find my list of appearances upcoming. I've got things booked up, actually quite a few things already for 2019, the Thriller Fest among them, BoucherCon, I'll be in Dallas. My first time in Texas coming up. I'm excited about that next year. And yeah, kind of everywhere. Actually, the other thing I'm excited about is Beyond the Truth, which, as I said, dropped today, is also the first book in this series that is available on audiobook as well.
Oh, nice.
Read by Adam Byrne. Yeah, so I'm pretty, pretty excited about that. I'm actually anxious to hear the story read by somebody other than myself, so that'll be interesting to hear how he treated that. So
That sometimes is hard. I mean, I've listened to audiobooks in the past. Somebody asked me actually what I thought of the audiobook, and I said, you'd be better off letting me read the print, seriously. Sometimes they do a very great job, and sometimes in this particular case, I was like falling asleep. I go, this is a monotone. There's no energy. There's no stress. There's no feeling. There's no emotion. Ay, ay, ay. I mean,
well, this was recorded by Adam Werner, and I'm excited. He's got a great voice for this. He does a lot of thriller and action adventure kind of books, and he's a stage actor, so he has the magnetism to do this that I would have to learn how to do. So I'm very excited. I'm sure he did a great job, and I'm looking forward to hearing that. So,
well, everybody, Hanukkah is coming very soon, and Christmas is coming. And Thanksgiving, you know, you can bring presents, people, for Thanksgiving if they're cooking for you, seriously. And I really think,
right.
you know, you need to know that, yeah. And the 2018, but I'm not going to tell you when or who, the 2018 Just Reviews, that's me, Books of the Year, will be presented on my show on December 20th with none other than, I'm so excited, Stephen James, Every Wicked Man. He asked for an interview. I'm, like, so thrilled. I can't believe it. So I will announce the winners then for my 2018, as soon as I decide on whether it's going to be 10 or 15 books in different categories. You never know what I'm going to do. I never know what I'm going to do either. So I want to thank you so much, very, very much. It's beautiful outside. Let me see. I don't know how much the temperature is by you, but here it's, oh, my God, it's hot. It's 46 degrees up in New York. It's not bad. It's great. I don't know how cold is it where you are.
It's 40 here, and it's partly cloudy.
Oh,
yeah, winter came early to Maine.
I know. And my niece, you're welcome. Everybody have a great day. Have a wonderful day. Stay warm. Stay somebody. And bye.